Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Abdullah Samir Show with your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim. And I'm joined by the Wok Nation guys. Soda, how do I say it? Soda Wow?
Soda Wow.
Soda Wow. Soda Wow.
Oh, my God.
So that means greetings,
I'm
right?
The language.
That means welcome.
Welcome?
Welcome, yeah.
Well, I guess you guys say marhaban as well. Is that common?
I guess sometimes, but not really.
Okay. So
I'm Arab by Somali, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I'm joined by two ex-Muslim Somalis, which is amazing. And we're going to be talking about, I was going to talk about atheism in Somalia, but then Khan, New Nomad, told me, oh, that's a little bit too aggressive. Let's just talk about apostasy first. Because apparently there's a lot of apostates that are also Christian, and they have this lot of things going on. That topic as well. So I want to get started first before I actually ask you guys about yourselves. What does Wok mean? You're the hosts of Wok Nation. What is Wok?
Do you want to tell them?
Yeah, I could definitely break that down. Well, pre-Islamic Somalis believed in a sky god, right? And that isn't just for Somalis, but most Cushitic people. Like you have the Oromos, the Afars, the Behas. Like so, a lot of and some people actually still practice it to this day in the Horn of Africa.
Oh, yeah.
So Wok is literally sky god. You know, so that's who was the deity that was worshipped, if you will, pre-Islamically in the Somali setting.
Ah, but you guys are not actually worshippers of Wok. You're taking the piss, so to speak, right?
But you know, I was just going to say, like, even though, you know, Somalia is like 100% Muslim country now, they still incorporate, like, Wok is still incorporated somehow in the culture. So collectively, the Somali memory has forgotten, like, the Wok religion or worship of Wok. But then, you know, linguistically, Wok still exists in the language. So, you know, there's a common word they use for paradise. It's called barwako. So it means rain from Wok. The actual word means rain from Wok. So rain from the sky god. So yeah. So it's just a play on words. Obviously we weren't going to call ourselves, you know, honestly, I kind of got Wok Nation from the play of, you know, how, you know, you're supposed to be one nation under Allah, and which obviously we're no longer a part of. So I guess, you know, it was just symbolic of the fact that, you know, Somalis, we don't really have an identity outside of Islam. Well, that's what Somali Muslims will say. Shout out to the haters. But that's what they will say, that we don't really have an outside identity outside of Islam. So Wok Nation was kind of like a play on that. Like, actually, we do. And we were once upon a time one nation under Wok. So, you know.
Nice. Yeah. So New Nomad, Khan, let's start with you. Okay. Because you are on time. let's start with you.
Leave the Australians alone.
So tell us about how you ended up atheist. Well, like Somalis, I always hear Somalis are 100% Muslim. So you must be Muslim. Like you can't be atheist.
Sure.
How did you become atheist? Like what happened?
And honestly, I wouldn't even because the thing is, okay. So let me just take it back a little bit. What happened was many years ago, I had a friend of mine who was a Bible thumper, right? I had a Bible thumper.
Essentially. Oh, yeah.
He was a Christian dude from the East Coast of Canada. And he was really, really into it. And, you know, so we would have these debates. We would have these really full-on debates. And you have to understand, like in the mind of, you know, me being a Muslim, of course, Islam is the truth, right? Of course, this is the only way. What are you talking about? You guys are just biding your time before you actually see the truth. That's the mindset, right? So I went on and tried to prove him wrong because we would have these actual debates. Turns out he knew the scriptures a little bit better than me. So what I had to do was I was forced to kind of go back and read the scriptures and actually read the Quran and read some of these hadiths. And what I still have my opinion. I remember reading through the Quran, trying to find nice passages to kind of give them a, you know, get a gotcha moment and see how much better Islam is type of thing. What happened is we would do this, and we did this throughout like a couple of years, I would say, honestly. But then one day I kind of went back to my Quran and to see where the highlighted stuff was. And I realized it was very few and far in between, right? So honestly, what I realized is that as a Muslim, you kind of take it as a culture more so than actually any kind of spirituality, because everything is so dictated in Islam. You know, you do this, you do that, you do this. And even the ones that don't do it believe that that's what they should be doing. Right. And that is the locked in mentality that Islam offers, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So essentially, I went back to my Quran and I looked at, you know, and I actually read it for the first time with a critical eye, as opposed to an already believing eye. Right. I wasn't bought in anymore. I was just kind of reading it with a little bit more criticism, because I found myself kind of seeding way and saying, yeah, you're right, because he would bring up all of the harsh things that we would either bypass or not talk about or sweep under the rug, in essence, right? And he would bring them up because he obviously didn't have the same respect for Islam that I did. So he would bring those things up and I would be in a position where I had to deal with it, whether it was in a good way or a bad way. But so I had a decision to make at one point, and the decision was, are you going to be sincere or do you just want to one-up him, right? And that's actually a conversation that I had internally. And I came out of it saying, well, if you're not sincere, then what's the point of all this? Then you're just lying and it's not genuine, right? Mm-hmm. So I didn't go around saying that I had the genuine thing if I wasn't going to be genuine in the way I approached the debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That being said, it very quickly became obvious that Islam wasn't what I was taught. Now, bear in mind, it takes time, but I mean, it was a bit of a shocker, because that was everything I've always believed in. It was a part of our routine. It was a part of everything. And that's when I kind of started then trying to separate culture from religion. So that's kind of been my pathway, just to kind of give you a bit of an overview.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me of a joke that we have as developers. I code in a language called JavaScript. So there's a book called JavaScript, mm-hmm. and there's a big fat book. And then there's a much smaller book called JavaScript, the good parts. And it's like a tiny little book. So if you did the same thing with the Quran, you have like the Quran, and then you have the Quran. Yeah, exactly. So Noon, do you want to tell us about yourself? And does your story mirror what happened with Khan, or is it different? Like, what happened with you?
I was going to say, you know, obviously I'm a woman, so I think my story is completely different. I think just before you introduced me as an activist, and, you know, I've said this so many times, I actually don't identify as an activist at all. I just identify as an individual who chose to leave Islam that happened to garner a lot of attention from my community, thanks to honor and shame culture. but really, you know, okay, you know, for me, you know what I'm guilty of? Probably being a little naive about internet culture, just not being a cool millennial. So what had happened with me was, around 2017, I joined Twitter. I just, like, prior to that, I used Facebook on and off, but I wasn't really somebody that was huge on social media, yeah? So again, I'm guilty of being kind of naive to internet culture, because I had no way of anticipating that me slandering Islam, minding my own business. I was just thinking, I'm just this little old Somali girl, random Somali girl from Australia. Who's going to care? You know, I'm just slandering the prophet, you know, yeah. Islam, you know.
Well, they call it slandering, right?
Yeah,
it's not slander. I mean,
it's my truth.
It's an opinion, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And honest to God, I've seen all these ex-Muslims. So I was so excited, because I had never seen, you know, people like us talk about, and you know, the tweets that I was seeing were so inflammatory, but I loved it, you know, because I was like, oh my God, I've never seen anybody talk about the things that I had in my head for years. So this is how I came out. So, I mean, look, as a woman, like, to be honest with you, I had friction with Islam all my life. You know, I started learning the Quran at 4 years old. I went to Islamic school, started going to Islamic school at four. I got to be honest with you, when I was young, I was not one of these people that had a struggle learning the Quran. Learning Arabic was easy for me. The Quran was, like, easy, like memorization. Like, so I wasn't really abused in madrasa and stuff like that. That wasn't my memories. My memories actually were, it actually kind of built my confidence because I was like, oh my God, I can memorize this other language so quick. You know what I mean? I was really good at it.
Was that in Australia or in Somalia?
In Australia, oh. Yeah. It's only now in hindsight that I look back at my education and realize that I was stunted because I spent so much time in my youth memorizing the Quran that I did not spend any time on, you know, science, you know, maths, like, you know, I mean, I didn't learn evolution as a child because I went to Islamic school. So it was up until I was 13, I didn't have a proper, I'd say, English science education until I went to a secular school. And I had a lot of catching up to do. But like I said, my journey, I feel like as a woman, as an ex-Muslim woman, is so different from your guys as men, you know, because we have this constant friction with Islam, you know. So as a girl, from the time you're 6 years old, you're cognizant of Aisha marrying the prophet. So there's always this kind of, as a Muslim girl, your childhood is cut short from that six-year-old point. Aisha didn't have a childhood, so don't you. You know what I mean? So that's how, so yeah, I guess my journey out of Islam.
Can you be more specific? Like what, like give some details, like what do you mean by that? Like when you said your childhood was cut short by Islam. So you already mentioned some of it. So, you know, obviously you were not, there was more focus on this religious aspect. Were you in Islamic school? So did you do secular stuff as well? But you spent more time on Quran? Like what happened there?
I mean, yeah, we did. We did have like other subjects that are mandatory, obviously, in Australian school. But honestly, this particular school got away with a lot because it was the first Islamic school of its kind. So the Australian government had they didn't actually check on us. They used to beat us, you know, at school. Oh. You know, my mom used to pay them. It was a private school. So we used to get paid to be assaulted and abused. But I was good at avoiding the beatings because I would actually do the work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but, you know, like when I say my childhood was cut short, I mean, you know, for us, we were taught to be wives from 6 years old. I was constantly taught about marriage, like to the point where I remember being 9 years old. And I remember being a young child and having suicidal ideation. You know how Armin Navabi talks about him trying to jump off a building because he wanted to stay a child, because he wanted to go to heaven? I had exactly that mentality as a child. Like, I loved Islam. I loved the Prophet. I thought him marrying a child was amazing. I thought dying as a child would be incredible because that's a guaranteed ticket to heaven. I just never wanted to hit puberty. So, like, now when I look back, I feel so sad for myself, how much I was brainwashed, you know, like, yeah. I was just really, I was like a seven-year-old Palestinian activist. I remember the way I used to hate Jews. I never met a Jew in my life, you know, like, I was born and raised in Australia. Imagine, all I used to talk about as a seven-year-old was, like, Israel. Like, I didn't know about evolution. I didn't know about Australian history even, you know what I mean? I didn't know so many things, but I just knew Israel was to blame for everything. Palestine needed to be free. I even knew the names of martyrs. I didn't know evolution though, you know.
So, wow. Yeah. It reminds me of what Hassan Radwan said. Hassan Radwan has a video where he says that you know, when you become Muslim, you have all of these things that you're assumed to have to pick up on as well. So you automatically, you know, Kashmir becomes an issue, Palestine, Chechnya. And yeah, like all of these things suddenly, you know, become a big issue. Not become a big issue. You become part of your identity, even though you have nothing to do with them, which is weird, right? But I mean, that's kind of part and parcel with the whole Islamic ideology. And this is why, I mean, it's a little bit dangerous too, because you have these people that are in America and the UK and everywhere, and suddenly, you know, out of nowhere, you have these people wanting to join ISIS. And I mean, that's the kind of extreme example.
I think that's what the whole concept of the Ummah is, right?
Yeah.
I often tell my my Somali people that, I think we're going to touch up on that later, but there is a specific way that we always kind of value, we take on all of the plight of all of these different Muslims. Mm-hmm. Simply because we have that shared identity.
Even Somalis were so.
Yeah, the thing, however, there really any actual action that is done. It's just the hatred that really resides within you. as for why these things are happening the way they're happening. And I think that's the unhealthy part, in my opinion. And I was telling my Somali people, I'm like, it's funny that when we speak of the Ummah, we'll talk about the Palestinian plight, we'll talk about the other plights, but never about the Somali plight. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a certain Arab supremacy within Islam, right? And I'm sure we can talk about that at length. But why does it only matters when it happens in specific parts of the world? Are Somali dying every day because they don't have proper water? They don't have, they're under the knees of Al-Shabaab, for example. There's all these things.
Gaza is better than Somalia. I swear to God, Gaza is better than Mogadishu. That's what offends me so much. We hear constantly about Gaza. Nobody talks about Mogadishu burning for the last 28 years. Well, I care anyway.
Yeah.
In case, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's definitely we want to raise awareness about our own places that we're from, which is, you know, I think a little bit of nationalism is a good thing because it allows us to care about people that we're otherwise not related to, right? In a way that you know when you live in a society, you're paying taxes and you're actually paying taxes for someone else to benefit from, in a way that you don't personally benefit necessarily, right? So it's the idea of working together. Obviously, too much nationalism is bad. Now, the problem with Islam is, you know, it puts a bunch of other stuff in there that have nothing to do with you. And, you know, and the problem is it makes the whole Palestinian-Israel thing just so much worse too. It just, the religion, you know, equation just makes it worse. And in Somalia, does the religion make, you know, like tolerance and, you know, co-living, does it make it more difficult living with Christians and Muslims? And can we talk about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I feel as though, like, for me, it's not about nationalism. For me, I'm like the least nationalistic person in the world. Like, I guess I do identify as an Australian, I will admit. But for me, when it comes to Somalia, people are dying of extremely preventable things, you know, like, you know, there's preventable violence, you know, like I just feel like as somebody who's privileged to be in the West of a Somali background, for me, like, I'm not going to be sitting here advocating for Gaza all day when I come from war-torn Mogadishu, you know, where they're blowing each other up, you know. So I think people, you know, Black lives really do matter to me, not in this kind of superficial way like we talk about in the West, where it's only a specific kind of Black life we talk about. But for me, you know, it's not about nationalism. It's just about Somalia is the literally the worst country in the world for human beings. Mm. So it's just a human rights issue. So, yeah.
And like, you know, like you said, when even in Australia, you were putting more energy, actually your parents put more energy into Quran over, you know, things that actually matter. Isn't that part of the problem for Somalia as well, where everybody is putting so much energy into the religion? And it actually makes you fall behind. Would you agree with that?
You know, I'm going to say in my parents' defense, because I feel that my parents migrated. So my parents came from Somalia as skilled migrants in the 80s. You know, in the 90s, there was no Black people in Australia. There was no, there was obviously Indigenous, but it's a different, you know, it's a 97% white. I think Australia is a very tough society to integrate into. Don't get it twisted. Like, I love Australia and I do my best to integrate, but I think it was very tough. I think my parents made the right decision with kind of pushing us with the Islamic community. So there was already an existing Arab Turkish community. So I think for my family, my parents were just like, okay, close enough. You know, let's keep my kids around the Desis, around the Arabs, Turks or whatever. I mean, did we experience racism? Absolutely. Were we radicalized? Of course. Like I said, I was a Palestinian activist. But that saying, I feel like my sense of confidence and well-being overall, I mean, I don't have this kind of chip on my shoulder about being Black that I may have had I gone to like all white schools, do you know? Yeah. So I wouldn't take my daughter to an Islamic school now, you know, given that Australia is much more multicultural. But I'm saying at the time, in hindsight, like,
oh yeah,
you know, yeah. I understand what my parents' thought process was at the time, you know.
I wanted to add, Abdullah, that we've got to be also confident.
Sorry, you cut out. You got cut off. Can you repeat that again?
We have to kind of be, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry. It was going robot voice for a second. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm an Android. Sorry. We have to be cognizant that this also happens within a context, at least in the Somali setting. I was born in Djibouti, which is a lot more, I would say, liberal in terms of the way religiosity is lived. It's a lot more liberal in a lot of ways. But within the, like, let's say in Somalia, what has happened is religiosity became sort of like the fallback plan after the war happened, because there was a lot of funding that was coming from the Arabic Hijaz, right? In Saudi Arabia. And all of that, they were importing not only money, but they were also importing a certain mentality, a certain depth to religiosity, right? So that's why you start seeing the chadors and the big niqabs and all of that, because Somalis at some level, I believe, it's my personal opinion, I believe, felt like they made Allah mad. And so that, because they feel like they've strayed away from the path of Islam, and that's why all this BS was happening in their country, so them reverting back to Islam was going to somehow maybe correct it. 30 years later, I don't see any difference, right? I mean, there's been a lot of difference, to be fair, but I just don't see any progress the way I like it to see.
I was just going to add in there the backlash against Sufism, because I think, devil's advocate here, I don't know if it sounds crazy, but I think in Somalia's defense, because Somalia used to be a Sufi country, right? So my tribe, particularly in Somalia, is super Sufi. So when I talk about Sufi, I don't know how to describe this to your listeners, but let me just say they are kind of like, very mystical, but they very, this is not politically correct, but they make things up as they go. Sufis, they really do. So my tribe and my family are very, they do the molids, you know, they're constantly throwing holy water on each other. They dance around. It's a little interesting. I'm not going to lie. They sing and dance.
Fun, isn't it?
It's a little scary sometimes. I'm not going to lie. So, so my family is from that world, right? So what I've found out, because my grandfathers are all chefs, Sufi chefs, right? So I found out when I visited London about 10 years ago, that to my horror and shock, that some of my grandparents, my great-grandfathers weren't that honorable, didn't have a lot of integrity, in that they would kind of make things up as they go and make use of, take advantage of the fact that Somalis don't speak Arabic. There's only a few Somalis speak Arabic, you know, and understood the Quran. So my tribe were kind of like learned people. So they would make things up as they go, you know what I mean? And they're like, yeah, this is, you know, so anyways, I said all this to say, basically, Salafism, if you look at Salafism and the Wahhabis, what they're offering is a very black and white, literal, do-it-yourself kind of version of Islam. You don't need nobody. Here's the rules, very clear. Nobody can change them. There's no chef that's going to come out. Do you know what I'm saying? And so it's very attractive to people who have been scammed effectively by people like my family, unfortunately. You know what I mean? So it's very attractive when you're being told, you know, by like essentially a wizard that's making up things as he goes for years and years, and that's the culture that you're from, you know, that you finally got the hard and fast rule book. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like that's why Somalis, it wasn't just like the civil war, it was like the civil war, we had secularism beforehand, so they were like, then we had this version of Islam that we had was like very, like I said, very airy-fairy, make up as you go. So when Wahhabism came after the civil war, it looked very attractive. Makes sense. Do you get what I'm saying? All I got to do is wear a tent. You know, my man's got to grow his beard out and we're all off to heaven. You know, it's very simple.
What's the mixture of the population now that are Salafi? Because most of the Somalis I know are Salafi. I don't know any Sufis Somalis. Like the masjid.
Grandparents are.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's generations past. Like I can honestly tell you that I've been told stories of my uncles doing an actual Islamic ceremony for the death of Bob Marley. No joke. So you can tell. Like,
I'm laughing because obviously, like the Islam I was taught, that's not allowed. I mean,
yeah, but that's the kind of Islam of my family. Wow. That's the kind of you know, that's how they were. You know what I mean? Like, kind of, you know, there's a lot of music, a lot of dancing. Like I said, like, a lot of great area.
We had rituals, right? To kind of to give honor, to praise the people that we love, that we lost, and all of that, right? Because we were humans.
Oh, worshiping the dead.
Exactly. Yeah, so what they did when Islam came is not that they got rid of them; they just put it under the guise of Islam. Mm-hmm. So you're still doing the same thing. I think there's something that's done when the woman is pregnant, and before it used to praise a Somali goddess, but now it praises Fatima, which is the prophet's daughter. They just changed exactly. They changed the facade of it into an Islamic facade. But they would be doing their thing anyways.
Do you think even with
and there's a lot of resentment as well. There's like a lot of resentment against Sufis as well. So my grandfather, so my mom's dad, it's my mom's dad's dad that is the big kind of famous sheikh. So, but my mom's dad, which is my grandfather, wasn't necessarily a sheikh, but he was like in the agricultural ministry and he was a writer and stuff like that. So anyways, he was an elder and he got killed in Black Hawk Down. Like in a bombing, pretty terribly, whatever. So obviously they built him a grave or whatever to honor him and stuff. And in 2010, Al-Shabaab attacked that. They bombed it to the ground. And the idea behind bombing it was because his father, people go and make pilgrimage to his father's grave and like kind of pray over and stuff like that. So they're constantly destroying, like, I don't think I even can go to see any of my ancestors' graves. They'll probably be destroyed. And they'll make a point of it because of this concept of worship and stuff like that. There's Sufis that will go to pilgrimages for those sheikhs rather than go to Hajj.
Mm-hmm. There's a hadith. You know, so this survivalism, this is Wahhabism right here, where they basically, based on these hadith, they're destroying graves.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And
this pretty much what ISIS does, yeah.
Yeah. This is a... It's just a step away from that, right?
Al-Shabaab has also done the same. Because we actually do have a lot, throughout the Horn of Africa, we have a lot of tombs of the forefathers.
Oh, yeah.
And it might be under the guise of Sheikh whatever, Sheikh this and Sheikh that, but it's really, he's the head of a family, this and that. And Al-Shabaab actually, I believe, they had taken a campaign where they destroyed a lot of these. And these are remnants of history that they're destroying, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And you don't tend to find, so this is a kind of weird dynamic. I always find this interesting because I was Salafi myself, and I know that Salafism, like official Salafism, like by the book Salafism, is against terrorism, is against killing of innocents and all these things. Mm-hmm. But yet, all of the terrorists are Salafi, not all of them, but like the vast majority of them, they tend to be Salafis, and they're the ones that they go from this peaceful Salafism to jihadi Salafism. You don't tend to find like Sufis becoming, I mean, it's possible, but it's not
very possible with Sufis.
Yeah.
But you know, that's my line. I always say, you know, not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Salafis.
Well, terrorists include a lot
of them,
people.
All of them are Salafis. Yeah, no, they are. But I'm saying, you know, in the Muslim, in the Islamic context.
Yeah.
Like, but that being said, I have to say, from a Sufi background, like, Sufis can be really crazy. I feel like, especially Westerners, people are like, oh my God, it's so wonderful you're a Sufi. Like, they're like, Rumi. I'm like, yeah, Rumi was nuts. These people are crazy, you know? They really are. So, it's just, it's a really, you know, that oriental view of Sufism as if it's this kind of great mystical thing when it's really exploitative when you look at it, how it manifests itself. Yeah.
So do you think Sufi Islam needs to go away? Like, I mean, you guys are both atheists.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We're not going to reach the
promised land. Well, you know what? The thing is, I'll say this. Just to be clear, I'll say this. I think Sufism has a lot of playfulness to it. But when you actually go deep dive into it, it's still Islam.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it still is Islam. It still has that codex. It still has those
misogyny and
it still has all those things built in.
And so, I think what Noon is kind of hinting to is a role like with Sufism, there's a lot of, you know, people taking advantage. There's a role murid and sheikh and kind of say whatever he wants. and he becomes a like a master with all these people, and he tells them to do this and do that, and they just have to do it because the it's a test, right? Like, I remember Bilal Phillips, I was Salafi myself, and he was talking about how some of these Sufis,
I hate that man,
that's
Noon's favorite chef, by the way. That's her favorite chef.
Bilal Phillips.
Oh, even as a Muslim, I hated him. I just feel like he's so, because he's a black chef as well too. I really can't stand that man.
Yeah,
can't stand him. You go on, Don.
but he made a good point. He was saying that, like, there's this blind obedience that they teach you, that okay, I'm gonna teach you not to have ego. And then, right. Well, how do you teach me not to have ego? Well, yeah, I'm gonna make you clean up after me, give me food, you know, do all, and sometimes it's even sexual exploitation too, right?
Of course.
Right, right.
It doesn't stop at,
well, they say, like, give my firstborn child. They give my what I heard was what my grandfathers used to do was they literally used to take people's firstborn child. People would feel compelled to give them their first, like, to be a house slave in their house. Right. You know? Like, oh, wow. And I'm like, what? So the resentment is real. Because people are just like, you know, I was trying to, you know, learn from your grandfather and he took my firstborn child as a slave.
There you go.
And, you know, this whole thing about trust and, you know, how, and by the way, thank you to William for the donation. When you trust someone, whether it's, you know, like not just the imams, but like when you have any sort of person that you trust, especially like a religious leader, whether it's a pastor or the imam or the Sufi sheikh, and you're leaving your kids with him, it becomes hard for you to see when there's abuse, because you know what I mean? Like, it's some human flaw that we have that we...
Well, it becomes personality worship, right? It becomes very quickly, it becomes a personality worship. And I think a lot of these chefs, and you can see videos right now because we're living in the 21st century. Even all of the crevices of the darkness of humanity are filmed today, right? So we can see people. There's a chef, right? In I'm not sure where he is in Somalia, but he's in Somalia. His whole thing is that he reads Quran on a barrel of water and he sprays a whole bunch of people with the water.
Okay.
Oh my God. Most of the people
are women, right? Most of the people there are women in niqabs and full, right? And he's spraying them with water.
Literally competition.
And people actually pay money. And these are people that are already not, you know, the most financially set of people. So he's taking money from needy mothers. Instead of that going to their kids, he's taking that money and he's spraying them with water. So they go in completely dry and come out wet, and they paid some money. That's the whole thing. So the level of ridiculous needs to be kind of called out at some level, right? If not religiosity, then this money can easily go to these kids that you have that you need to feed, right? It's just a more practical approach.
At the very least, that's part of it. I mean, worse than that is just like they think that this is actually going to solve some problems. Like, let's say they have, you know, some sort of mental issue. You know, like, it could be schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a very real issue some people suffer from. They hear things. There's nothing there. And sometimes they even know there's nothing there, but they're still hearing it. There's one TED talk of a woman that says she sees a clown in the corner of her vision everywhere she goes. And these tend to be scary images. They're not like smiling clowns. They're like scary clowns or whatever. Yeah. You know, sometimes the voices are telling you, like, you're an idiot, you're a fool. I know one guy who has mental health issues in his family. His mom was, you know, institutionalized, and he has issues too. And it got triggered from some stress in his life. And he was saying he was hearing, you're stupid, you're an idiot. Like, it was bad things he was hearing. So can you imagine? You're in a culture where you're told jinns are real, and you're hearing.
Exactly.
What are you gonna think? You're gonna think I have a mental disorder. And you know the funny thing is, you take antipsychotic drugs, and these jinns go away, right?
Yeah.
And that therein lies the crux of a huge problem that's happening in the diaspora and in Somalia. So now we have a race, I think, of somewhere where it's somewhere ridiculous, like something at least over 70% to 80% PTSD rate. Because obviously we've had a civil war and subsequent bombings, we have a culture of bombings. People are literally dying every week to the point of there's an apathy when it comes to violence. Do you get what I'm saying? Because people, and I feel as though the Somali community has got such trauma levels. Like, I honestly, I've received a lot of abuse and threats and violence since being obviously coming out on Twitter. Shout out to all those people. I'm not mad at you at all. I'm just saying, because I'm not mad at them, because I feel that we come from a community that's really traumatized. Violence is normal to us. As you said, you know, a lot of these people do have schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is huge in my family. Like, I've got several family members, unfortunately, that are really unwell. And absolutely. And the challenge of getting them on medication is, you know, we get them on antipsychotic medication. Then what happens is obviously the voices stop, the delusions stop. And but they attribute that to dua and prayer, you know. So it's like a cycle.
You have people in your family that had this issue. And they took antipsychotic drugs and solved the gin problem.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. This is the story of my life. Like, literally, but I know that many people. It's really common.
But they also, so if they also did the dua, as long as they don't stop the drugs, like, they can do dua.
The problem is they don't have insight. The problem is with most of the mental health issue, like schizophrenia, you know, when you talk about personality disorders, you know, when they're in manic state of bipolar and stuff, these people, they don't have insight into the thing. So insight is like knowing that you're unwell, knowing that you're sick.
Yeah.
That barrier, by the way, so insight can be blocked by, like, so things like stigma can stop, obviously, people getting help, because they obviously stigmatize themselves. They don't want to be labeled. Like, there's just so many things that go into it. And then religion, for me, is the worst aspect of it. So for me, what I've seen is religion, it just has become the thing that has stopped people from getting help in my community. And I'm talking, like, put it this way, it's so common. Like, I go to the psych ward, honestly, I'm there like every month. Like, put it this way, all the mental health people in Melbourne know me, because I'm obviously always visiting family members, and I've got several family members I'm a carer for. Whenever I go there, I have this heartbreaking moment. I look around and I see other Somali women with jilbabs. I'm talking about women, 6-7 children, because they've been abandoned by men who've married other women back home in Somali. We've got this, like, we've got huge problems. Islam is like, you know, for me, exacerbating the problems and stopping us from talking about them. Yeah.
You were going to say something, Khan?
Yeah, Islam, just to carry on what Nuno was saying, Islam is often used as a justification because, you know, leaving someone, going somewhere else, marrying 2-3 other women, having their, you know, other families, that can easily be justified and explained away. And it doesn't matter how you feel about it, because if you've bought in, then you have to submit. That's what Islam stands for, submission, right? So you've got to submit to whatever, however you disagree with it, it doesn't matter. It's not about you, it's about the word of God. And I think that's like the biggest kidnapping of the soul, if you will. Like, it really just kind of holds people in this position where they're like, I can't agree with that, but I have to agree with it. Like, it's in this
hard. It creates it. I actually believe it creates mental illness. Like, following me down this rabbit hole, I actually believe that Islam is creating mental illness in my people. So what's happening, especially in the West, we've already had a civil war. These people are traumatized for other reasons. They've had a civil war over tribal issues. They come to the West, right? You know, the men themselves have obviously, because Islam allows them to marry four women, and the men themselves are traumatized themselves, have got issues. You know, they might be struggling to get jobs themselves. They might feel emasculated in this Western society, you know. So they take that frustration out on their women. So it's either they're either abusing the women physically, and that's justified in Islam, or they will just abandon that family altogether. Because a lot of the men, and it's like everybody's a victim in this situation, because the men just feel pressure. They don't know where they fit in the society. Their kids are just like going left, right. So they're probably just thinking, maybe it's this wife, you know what I mean? Let me just get a new wife. They've got depression and anxiety and PTSD themselves. They're like, let me just go back home and maybe marry a new woman. It's halal for me, you know? So again, it's not the men's fault, you know? Islam allows it. Let me just go back to, you know, get another wife, see how it goes.
They try to remedy mental illness through the
problems.
Right.
Not only through the Quran, but also through actions. Like, for example, they're like, let me go marry a younger, more pretty wife. Maybe that will cure my depression. Do you get what I'm saying? A lot of these men are depressed as well, too. So then that doesn't work. And then meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, your first wife is having a nervous breakdown and the children, they're abandoned. So they're, you know, now at Black Lives Matter protests. But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You see, it's a flow-on effect. You know what I'm saying? The whole community is like seriously in, and the women, and the reason why it causes mental illness is because the woman is like that's wearing this jilbab, this covering, you know, she's trying to cover, she's trying to be the best pious woman, and she's seeing her life falling apart. You know, her man's off married a younger woman. Yeah. She might have been abused, and that's justified. Her children are off in this Western world. She doesn't fit. She can't make friends with the Jennifer across the road. She can't understand her, you know, so she's like trapped. You start talking to yourself, and in that starting to talk to yourself, that's where the mental health issues begin, you know?
I was going to say, isn't that related to kind of becoming a, you know, like getting involved in society, speaking the language and, you know,
integration,
Integration.
But if you have a religion that teaches you Kafirs are not to be trusted, never befriend. I think there's a verse that says, never befriend a non-Muslim.
Absolutely. Yeah. If when you're put in a position of being supreme, I remember coming to this country and feeling and thinking I'm better, right? And never really pausing to for 1 second saying, well, then why am I coming here? Why aren't they coming to me, right? If I'm so great. But the thing is, this built-in arrogance comes through even if you're coming to another country. Right, so that's why you're gonna see a lack of assimilation. That's why you'll see a lack of
Because Allah gave them the visa, not Jennifer. Yeah. It wasn't Allah that gave them. It wasn't the UN. The UN. It wasn't Sweden that actually approved the visa. It was Allah and my du'a in the refugee camp that helped me get to this Western world. I mean, these Westerners are just facilitating Allah's will, you know.
So we're talking here about specifically Somalis who are coming to the West, were not immigrating based on wealth or job or anything. We're talking about people that are coming from troubled countries, war-torn like situations, refugees. And what you're saying is they're not assimilating well, and they have a lot of mental health issues. Is that's what you're saying?
I would say it's like, okay, listen, these are resilient people. I don't want to put Somalis down to make it seem like they can't be helped and there is a lost cause. I'm from the same, you know, people. My genetics haven't changed. I always try to remind people I'm one generation removed from the desert, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not as if they don't have potential. It's just that they need tools, they need help. You know, I was lucky to be born in Australia. That's why I'm not as traumatized as my people. I feel as a secondhand trauma just from hearing their stories. But that being said, I feel as though if the West had more thoughtful integration programs that, you know, took the mental health of refugees into consideration, because a lot of these people are fleeing bombs and stuff like that. You know, for example, in my mum's case, like, you know, she's really traumatized over the way my grandfather was killed. He was killed in a bombing by Americans. You know, we couldn't find my grandfather's brains were scattered in a million different directions, you know. So this is my mum. They couldn't even get his body together to bury him. So my mother, she replays that over and over again, you know, like her father was her hero. It's very deep, you know what I mean, for people. So you can imagine people that have been gang raped in refugee camps or whatever. So what I'm trying to say is you can't just let those people off a plane and be like, okay, here you go, do some welfare and off you go. You know, they need programs, they need help, you know, and it's incumbent on Westerners as well to help them integrate. It's not about, you know, just blaming those refugees, you know, like it's incumbent on us to help them as well to.
Because you'll find Somalis in the whole spectrum. You'll find Somalis
exactly
on the liberal side, and you'll find Somalis at the very rigorous side. I think what we're trying to do with a project like Walk Nation, for example, one of the things that we're trying to do, and I always say this to Noon too, is that when I say I'm an apostate or I don't believe in Islam and things like that, they'll say, then you're not Somali, because there's this link that's always made with being Somali and being Muslim, right? And you'll hear that repeated oftentimes. 100% of Somalis are Muslim. Well, that means me and Noon are not a part of that 100%, right?
Yeah.
So it's just literally, it's just not true, right? Because there's Christians, there's even a Somali clan that was that were Hebrews and had Judaism, but that was beaten out of them, and they became Muslim because of obviously they wanted to live. What I tried,
you cut off again.
With Rock Nation, I believe one of the projects. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Sorry. One of the projects that we're trying to do is to, you know, when you say you no longer believe and they say, well, then you're not Somali. Then I say, well, can we not say then that Islam is an Arabic religion? And they'll say, no, Islam is for everyone.
Yeah.
So, and you see where I'm going with this, because what we're trying to do essentially, and one of the things that we try to push is that we want to uncouple Islam from Somaliness the way they uncouple Islam from, you know, being Arab.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's a bigger project, because as soon as our people are even, we're very pioneerish, because we're just trying to have the conversation. We're literally just trying to have the conversation, because Islam and Somaliness are so intertwined that we're trying to undo that and say, well, I'm still going to So what has happened is that we fall back to our Somaliness, hence Wok Nation, hence what we portray to be as Somaliness, and kind of re-embrace the fact that we're from the Horn of Africa and we're people that existed prior to Islam and hopefully will exist after Islam is gone.
Absolutely. Although I don't think Islam is going away anytime soon, we're definitely seeing a big change in the population and the demographics. And I want to ask you about that. Yeah. Before I do that, I want to tell everyone to check out Wok Nation. I have the link there in the chat and it's in the description as well.
Thank you.
Podcast done by these two fellow beautiful souls here. So do check that out.
And some other guys too.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a bigger project than just you two. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are new here to your Friendly Neighborhood Ex-Muslims channel, please do consider joining. Click join now below. The money does help. Thank you very much. And if you are new here, you can also subscribe. You don't have to pay money. You're free to join as well just by subscribing. Thank you all. And now let's get back to it. So what do you think is happening? So we're talking a lot about Somali refugees. There's also Somalis who are not refugees. Like I know in Kenya, some of the most wealthy people are Somalis. Mm-hmm. Like my uncle lives in Kenya and he was showing me these couple of buildings on his video that they own the whole building. Yeah. They're so rich and some of them, they come here and they're wealthy. So there's different types of people. Do you think even with the well-off Somalis that religion is still causing problems for them in their lives? And why would you say it is?
I think religion just, again, creates its apathy and arrogance. Like, I just feel as though there are absolutely so many successful Somalis. Shout out to them. And actually, I'm one of these people that I don't talk about Somali issues. So other people can kind of look at Somalis and be like, oh my God, you know, yet another Somali drama. I actually do this so just to talk to other diaspora people like myself, that may have a little bit of resources, may have, you know, some contact, just to be like, we can help ourselves. You know, we can help our own communities. We can lift ourselves out of whatever, you know. So, going back to the whole, you know, the religious, the wealthy Somalis, particularly in Kenya, in Tanzania, like, I just feel that, again, Islam creates this dynamic. I just look at Israel, for example. Israel, I think 75 years ago, these people were in a camp, you know, being murdered by the millions, you know. Auschwitz was open. So I just want to say, like, in 75 years, these people built a nation that we are now, we take notes from Israel when it comes to medical advancement, science, about all this stuff. So it can be done. But I just feel, for some reason, for the last 30 years, not much development has happened in Somalia. Mm-hmm. And that is because of, I believe, tribal culture that is reinforced by Islam. Because I feel like if we didn't have Islam, we would have progressed. And Islam stops innovation. You know what I'm saying? And innovation of allowing for ideas and stuff like that. Ideas like, you know, nationalism, you know, all of these ideas we could have borrowed.
Humanism, veganism.
Veganism. Yeah. So many things. But we can't use any other idea but Islam. So I would
also say, if I can say this, I think what we have to also understand is that socioeconomics do make a difference. All right. So if you're well off in socioeconomics, chances are you might not be holding on to something like a religion as much as you would if you were poor, because you just have, you know, when you're poor, that's, you need hope. And I think that's what religion
offers.
And people that are the most zealous sometimes, I feel, are lacking in socioeconomics. So I would say that, and you have to understand, like, if you come from a, you know, a well-off place and well-off Somalis, you could at the very least have the conversation. Mm-hmm. I would argue that you could at the very least have the conversation. Now, this is not a blanket statement. It's really based on my experience. But when people are doing well for themselves, they can at least sit down and talk with you in confidence. But if they're not, and then if they're lacking, or they're in poverty or abject poverty, you are insulting their whole time, right?
Yeah, because you know what. Sorry, I'm interrupting you, because hard to know when someone's done. It's religion and us in general, we are emotional beings first. And a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people think we are rational beings first. One of the biggest insights I've got from reading this book, Everything is Fucked by Mark Manson, beautiful book. I mean, it's
really,
the guy writes it like so chill. I mean, just from the title, you can see that. But the book was so profound, because one of the biggest lessons I learned is that we are emotional beings first and rational beings second. We think we're rational beings. We think we're in charge. We think we're all logical and everything, but we're not. We're actually emotional. So, you know, frankly speaking, I mean, that's the situation. Now, because you do have to get going, I want to end off on something positive. Or it could be negative. I don't know. We'll see. So I want to ask you guys, both of you, how is life now after leaving Islam? Like, obviously, I'm going to say before you answer that I do understand that sometimes when you leave Islam, there's a bad phase you have to go through. Family members are not happy and, you know, struggles. Obviously, both of you are grown up. Like, you have kids of your own and everything, which is great. You're not living under someone else's roof. So you can do what you want. You're living in the West. These are all positive things. But, you know, not everyone has, you know, all of those blessings, right? So how are you doing right now? And do you have anything you want to say about that? Whoever wants to go first.
I'll get mine out of the way. But the thing, what I would say is that you're absolutely right. And we're by no means advocating for people that are not free or that are not independent, rather, to be kind of yelling at the top of their lung. We have to still be cognizant of that. That does exist. I'm a fully grown man. I have really no reason to be, you know, if I'm not exercising my free speech in a place where free speech is permitted, then, you know, what's the point of even having it? Yeah. What I would say is that personally, my way of looking at it is that I want to just engage people in conversation, because the thing is, even if minds are not changed, minds can still come together and come up with some sort of I'm a bit of an optimist, but I really do believe that that's the way forward, because trying to make people believe things is, I look at someone trying to proselytize to me Islam, and a lot of times it's people that I know more of. I know more about Islam than these people talking to me about Islam. Oftentimes, I just want to be able to take the words of XMNA, normalize dissent, and to actually have these conversations. I just want to open up the bridges to have these conversations, and I believe that to be the way forward for my Somali people, honestly.
Beautiful. And would you say your life is better now as an ex-Muslim?
I honestly, to be very, very quite honest, if you're talking about outwardly, nothing has really changed, because I was on that same path.
Yeah.
But internally, yes.
Yeah.
Internally, I am able to follow. I am able to have the courage to follow my curiosity. I'll put it like that.
Beautiful, beautiful. And how about you, Noon?
I just want to finish my original thought, which was, I'm not an activist. I'm not an activist. And I'm just like a victim of the culture, really. I just want to say, I'm not an activist. I'm nobody's prophet. You know, I'm nobody's leader. Don't be messaging me nothing. You know, I'm just speaking for myself as an individual. No, I have to stress this, because some dickhead from Pakistan or Somalia or something is going to message me. So I got to clarify that, all right? I'm nobody's prophet. I'm just here to say that I'm just happen to be a Western-born girl that just happens to deal with honor and shame culture in a Western context. You know what I mean? That's really all I got to say.
Well, and would you say your life is better now after leaving Islam?
Like I said, on the with my dealings with how I deal with people, I'll say no. Being a Muslim was much easier because I had a lot less judgment. Everybody thought of me as a victim. You know, I feel as though, particularly now that I am an ex-Muslim and especially as a Black woman, I'm very inconvenient for a lot of people, you know, especially in the social state of Victoria, which I live in Australia. These hipsters, they, being an ex-Muslim, honest to God, has been exhausting for me. You don't know how much backlash I've received from the Australian left-wing community, just because I won't allow them to victimize me. And at the same time, I just receive abuse from my community and I'm not protected from that. So no, my safety is not, I don't feel, but in my spirit and in my soul, I'm free. You know, in my mind, I'm free. You know, when I go to sleep at night, I sleep really good, let me tell you. When I laugh from my soul. That's something that I never felt as a Muslim. So shout out to anybody that doesn't like me, but that's something that you'll never be able to take. You know?
That's the haters.
So anyway.
More of a shout out to the people that are actually like-minded, because that's, I think, what we need to cultivate, to kind of have people, these kinds of gatherings of the mind from all walks of life and all types of different things, and talk about how Islam affected us and to at least open up the conversations. Maybe that way, freedom riders won't be hacked to death in around the world.
Bangladesh. I know. Shout out to the women of Iran. Honest to God, shout out to the women of Iran. Every time I feel down about being an expert, especially when these Westerners, you know, malign you, because believe it or not, actually, a lot of Muslim women silently support me, or they understand my thinking because they understand this culture. You know what I mean? They might not like the things that I say openly, but they get it. You know what I mean? So they won't say nothing to me. But it's these Westerners that social justice warriors, believe it or not, Black, white, I've even had Asian people that have never been Muslim in their life. They're the worst people on earth. Like when it comes to this issue, you know, about silencing us. So,
wow. Yeah. I haven't had as much. It seems like you've had a lot more backlash than me. I've only once or twice sort of this run. And like, what happened? You want to give an example?
I was going to say, I think it's because I'm black and a woman. And no, I really do know. I'm the last person to use the Black card, but I really do think it offends people that I feel like I'm the captain of my own destiny. People are like, how dare you? You know, people are like, you should be a victim. I'm like, I'm not a victim, bitch. Yeah. Like, so that attitude offends these people because they want to pat me on their head like their little puppy and tell me that I'm a victim, you know?
Yeah.
So the fact that I have the audacity to self-actualize, believe it or not, is offensive. It's political and it's offensive because I'm a Black woman. But that's a whole other conversation for another day.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming, and I know you have to get going, Khan, and thank you. Definitely appreciate you guys coming on here, and you know, so like you said, no problem. And you guys, do everyone in the chat and whoever's watching this later, do check out Walk Nation, the podcast. It's going to be big. It's going to be so big after this show goes live. You're going to see.
Oh my God!
You want to grow it, and especially and it's in English, right? So it's not.
It's in English.
English.
I'm almost like scared of the clout.
To get some Somali content as well, just to kind of appeal to different demographics within the Somali community, of course. But mainly is for diaspora Somalis, right? The whole Somali.
And there's many of us, just to clarify.
Yeah, there's a Kenya.
So you're going to see different faces, different names, you know.
Definitely. I'm always happy to support my fellow YouTubers there. And I know you're not activists. Okay. You know, I know you said that you're not activists, but
I'm not an activist, exactly. It's going to be
whatever you
are. I don't understand. These people are going to come after you, you know, anyway.
I do feel as well. I don't know what it is. I mean, we don't have time now to talk about it, but if you're a woman, it's much worse. I've seen that from other ex-Muslim women. Yeah. Zaira K, and you know, like you said yourself, they just brunt of the abuse. These men are, I mean, these abusers are wimps, the cowards, they're picking on women all the time. I mean, they don't come to me. They want to pick on, you know,
and
they don't
get women as well too. I would get death threats from women. I would get death threats from men, and like abuse threats and like race threats. And then I would get Muslim women, believe it or not, telling me to kill myself. And then I would get white women, like white lefty, these people that have got Black Lives Matter in their crying, literally. Sending me messages. Like, I remember this one woman named Elizabeth. Wherever you are, Elizabeth, in France, I'm going to whoop your ass one of these days. But anyway, this Elizabeth, she was like, curse, Moon. Oh, you're curse. Australian. No, I'm not. Yeah, anyway, whatever. What was it going to say? She was like, you're Australian. She goes, Australia doesn't want you. She goes, she's literally told me I'm a nigger. Like, this is a person with Black Lives Matter in their thing. She went back and forth with me saying to me that, you know, I was unwanted in Australia. I'm like, mate, they want my taxes, mate. I'm very wanted. Like, so she was like belittling me and stuff like that. But it's that kind of constant, you know your place as a brown person, yeah. And it's beneath us, you know. Anyway.
Oh my God. Okay, well, we'll end on that. Yeah. So Elizabeth,
okay,
you should apologize for that. That wasn't
watch
really
out. Nice. You watch out.
And thank you guys again. And
thank you, Abdullah, for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Take care, guys. Bye.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Okay.